compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, hello there. Nice to see you. Nice to... you really can't see me, can you? But you can hear me. I hope you can hear me. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Chances are you have that on speed dial already. Hey, if you or someone you love requires insulin, you're going to like this story. This is some good news being reported by the New York Times. There is a bill that has unanimous support from Democrats as well as 12 Republicans, and it is intended to benefit millions of Americans with diabetes, or as Wilford Brimley would say, diabetes. May he rest in peace. He had a bit part in the Waltons, by the way, back in the day, long before he became associated with diabetes. If this becomes law, it will limit the cost of insulin to simply $35 a month. So for Americans who depend on it, and that's millions, it would be very affordable, $35 a month. The bill would have substantial benefits for many of the nearly 30 million Americans who live with diabetes. Insulin is a life-saving drug that is typically taken daily. It has grown increasingly expensive in recent years, and many diabetes patients ration their medicines or discontinue them because of the cost. About one in five Americans who take insulin would save money under the proposal. The insulin bill represents a substantial scaling back of the ambitions on the Democratic Party side to tackle high drug prices for all Americans. A broader prescription drug package written as part of the $2.2 trillion social spending and climate bill that has stalled in the Senate would limit price increases on all prescription drugs, improve the generosity of Medicare's drug coverage, and allow the government to negotiate directly on the price of some drugs used by Medicare patients, also while limiting insulin copayments. So, good news if this passes. Now, I'm not here to to defend, because I don't even fully know what all else is in that $2.2 trillion package. I don't know. And there may be things in there that I would find objectionable. But at least this is a bright spot, and hopefully this little piece of legislation can stay in there. Because I've known personally some people. I have a friend who's a Catholic priest, and he has to take insulin several times a day. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think he has to take it either just before or just after he eats a meal. And he's like totally not bothered by it. He carries his little package of syringes with him wherever he goes. And he's a religious, so he has a big habit, a big flowing habit. So you don't even see this package of syringes. And when it's time to eat, he pops one out and, you know, a stick in the belly or the arm or wherever he gives it to himself. And then he can eat without the side effects. So I've always marveled at people who have to go through that. And for many of them, it's just a way of life. So if it's possible to bring those prices down, I say A-OK to that. 888-914-9149. Now, something I don't say A-OK to is some stuff that's been happening in the background over the last, last couple of days. And this has to do with the never-ending transgender drama, this ideological tsunami that we're facing. Two bits of information I want to share with you here. The first one, this is an article by Timothy Nerozzi. And this is talking about how the Department of Health and Human Services, and specifically its Office of Population Affairs, released a document yesterday titled Gender Affirming Care in Young People, which sounds nice. I mean, I think we should care for everybody, including young people. This HHS document describes what it calls appropriate treatment for transgender adolescents, including TOP surgery. And you say, TOP surgery, what is that exactly? Well, I hate to say this, I hate to tell you, but in the case of females, it is surgery to remove breasts and to make the chest appear more masculine. And bottom surgery, I probably don't even need to say what that is, right? And I'm not talking about your posterior. Bottom surgery does not refer to your caboose. It refers to something else. And in the case of females, and in the case of males, two different kinds of surgery intended to make the body appear to be of the opposite sex. It doesn't change anything other than you now have a mutilated body. So it's, this bill, this document, excuse me, is promoting this. Medical and psychological gender-affirming healthcare practices, the document says, have been demonstrated to yield lower rates of adverse mental health outcomes, build self-esteem, and improve overall quality of life for transgender and gender diverse youth. So they're propelling these people forward into this. They want to grease the skid, so to speak. They want to make it as easy as possible. In fact, they're going to get behind and push them in this direction. That's what this really amounts to. The document says, for transgender and non-binary children and adolescents, early gender-affirming care is crucial to overall health and well-being, as it allows a child or adolescent to focus on social transitions and can increase their confidence while navigating the healthcare system. It may include evidence-based interventions such as puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormones. How about the whole evidence-based, science-based outcomes? It doesn't matter how you mutilate your body. And some people, perhaps even a large number of them, percentage-wise, after a certain number of years, they get to the point where they regret having done that. Sexchangeregret.com is a website. I've talked about it before. It's a website written by a man who himself went down that road, and he thought he was a woman, so he had all the various surgeries involved, and he tried to live as a woman for over 8 years, and then he ran straight into the brick wall of regret. And what have I done? And oh my gosh, what was I thinking? And he quote unquote transitioned back. I mean, you can't really transition from being a man into a woman. You can't become a woman if you're a man. If you're a woman, you can't become a man. You can dress like a man. You can take hormones that will lower your voice, that will make you grow facial hair, maybe put on some muscle bulk. You can have surgeries and mutilate your body. But that none of those things makes you a man. This talk about transitioning is empty because it's meaningless. It doesn't really happen, is the point. And now the federal government is, they're just pushing this from here to kingdom come. President Biden, who's very much into this, he gave a speech. It was a video message. And this was released to mark the International Transgender Day of Visibility. This is courtesy of the New York Post, article by Stephen Nelson. And in it, he says that transgender people are made in the image of God and that their parents should affirm their gender identity. And if you're interested in seeing the video, it probably will make you ill, especially if you have a friend or a loved one who's going down this path of delusion and nobody's helping these people, but everybody like President Biden and, you know, all the others in the federal government who are part of this, they're actually enabling this problem. They're pushing it. They're promoting it. But I'd like to pause here rather than read to you all of the empty rhetoric from President Biden. And that's all it is, just empty rhetoric. But he makes a point here that's actually not true. He says, transgender people are made in the image of God. It doesn't mean that transgender people aren't made in the image of God, but what he thinks that means is not what it means. Here's what I mean by that. Everybody, every man, woman, and child is made in the image of God. In fact, the Bible says in the book of Genesis that we're made in the image and likeness of God. Now, that's not repetitive. That's not redundant. They mean two different things. So let's unpack it. To be made in the image of God, which is true of all human beings, to be made in the image of God means that you are like God insofar as, like God, you have an intellect and a will. That's what this refers to. God does not have a body. He's a pure spirit. So he doesn't have male or female characteristics. He revealed himself to us through his son, Jesus Christ, in masculine terms, but it doesn't mean that God is male. It doesn't mean God is a father, but it doesn't mean that God is male in the sense that human beings are male and female. And you may say, well, why is that? Well, human beings are male and female for a very particular reason, and that is because we procreate. So if you're married and you have children, you're participating in that act of procreation, and you can do that because of your humanity. You are able to procreate. Because of the male and the female. That's the way our species procreates. There are other species that don't require male and female. And there are some species that are both male and female. Certain plants, for example, are both, they have both male and female apparatuses in terms of their reproduction. But of our species, human beings, there are both male and female. We need each other in order to procreate. And that's why we can say that, you know, we are made in God's image and likeness, not because of our bodies, not because of male and female, but because we, like God, have a share in his nature in this sense, and that is that you have an intellect by which you know what is true and a will with which you choose what is good. Fundamentally, those are the primary operations of your soul, to know and to love. To know and to choose is another way to put it. So that's how we're made in the image of God. So anything else is just a misunderstanding of what that phrase means. Now, what does it mean, as long as we're at it? What does it mean to be made in the likeness of God? So to be made in the image and likeness of God, once again, it's not redundant. It's not just saying the same thing twice. To be made in the likeness of God refers to God being holy, and to the extent that you are holy, you participate in his holiness by his grace that comes to you, let's say through the sacraments, etc., then you are more like God. So you're made in his image, regardless of whether you believe in God or not, regardless of whether you've been baptized or received any of the sacraments or not. Nonetheless, you're still made in God's image by virtue of the fact that you have an intellect and a will. But you are made in his likeness to the extent that you become like God, and that is his holiness, his righteousness. So if you have the stomach for it and you want to read the transcript of this whole thing, the New York Post has got some excerpts of it. One that I will read to you. I mean, you can read it for yourself by going to the Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. But part of what President Biden said, also just a blatant falsehood, he says, to parents of transgender children, affirming your child's identity is one of the most powerful things you can do to keep them safe and healthy. Any transgender American who is struggling, please know you're not alone. Well, I mean, on the surface, sure. No, how can you argue with that? I agree, in a general sense, that you have to affirm your child's identity as your child, as somebody who is loved by God, somebody for whom Christ died on the cross. But that's not what he means by this. I don't think that's what he means. What he means is, if your son or daughter comes to you and says, you know, let's say it's your daughter, you know, Mom, I think I'm trans. I want to transition and become a boy. Well, honey, you're only 12 years old. Yeah, I know, but I really do think I'm trans. Okay, you're not supposed to affirm that. You're supposed to help her. And the most powerful thing you can do as a parent is to keep your children safe. As he says, we got to keep our children safe. How do you keep them safe? You speak the truth in love to them. You don't enable a delusion. And I've used this analogy before. I think it's an appropriate analogy. Tell me what you think. And that is the analogy between a daughter, let's say, who thinks that she's a man and wants to have the surgeries and all the other things that go with the so-called transitioning process. And she tells you this, she's 12 years old, versus the same daughter who, in a different scenario, is convinced that she's fat. And so because she has anorexia nervosa, she wants to lose as much weight as possible because in her mind, she's convinced that she's fat. She's really not fat. The science tells you she's not fat. The scale tells you that she's not fat. You look at her and you can see that she's not fat. She's emaciated. So what do you do with that 12-year-old daughter if she comes to you and says, hey, Mom, I'm so grossly overweight. I want to stop eating. I just don't want to eat anymore. I don't want to eat very much because I don't want to get any fatter. I want to lose weight. Would you be a good parent if you said, okay, honey, sure. Yeah, no problem. We'll padlock the refrigerator. No more food for you. If that's how you feel, if you're honestly convinced in your own mind that you're fat, even though science says you're not fat, the scale says you're not fat, I can tell that you're not fat, your skin and bones. Okay. Would you be a good parent or a bad parent? And you know the answer to that question. You'd be a bad parent because you'd be harming your child by playing into that delusion. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily her own fault. Who knows why some young women develop this eating disorder? But that's what it is. It's an eating disorder. And so if you're going to be a good mother or a good father, you're going to try to get help for your daughter so that she can overcome this delusion, so that she doesn't kill herself as some young women eventually do. They starve themselves to death. I can never talk about this topic without thinking about Karen Carpenter. You know, the Carpenters, we've only just begun. That's how she died. She developed anorexia nervosa. She was already a rather slender woman to begin with. She developed anorexia nervosa, and she was convinced that she was overweight. She wound up starving herself to death. I think in the end it was cardiac arrest. I think that her heart just gave out because her body was so ravaged by this emaciation. And I suppose because she was, you know, an A-lister, and there probably were very few people who could really get to her and tell her, you need to stop this. And she wound up dying as a result of it. And all that wonderful music that we might have had from her, if she had lived, we'll never know about that. So that's my editorial comment on this issue. The federal government is now flying gay pride flags and the so-called trans flag in front of federal buildings and embassies around the world. I mean, this psychosis has set in at practically every level. So this is why when you hear me talk about this, I'm appealing to you individually. I'm appealing to you as a mom, as a dad, so that you will take a stand, at least in your own family, at least with your own children. I know you want to. This is a topic that comes up a lot. And therefore, that's why I return to the topic from time to time, not because this is a hobby horse or not because I want to, you know, bring you down or anything like that. But this is a real problem that very likely you're going through, or somebody you love is going through this, and you need to know how to deal with it. And the simple way to deal with it, if you ask me, is speak the truth in love. Speak the truth in love. Let's see. Can we get to a call? I think we can. Let's go to Rosa in Brooklyn, New York. Good morning, Rosa.
Good morning, Patrick. If it was true that, you know, we could just find a parent and tell that child, you know, well, you know, you're this or that, and it was not against the law, you know, then it would be up to the parents to take care of that child, no matter what that child tells the parent. But it is against the law for the parent to take that child when that child comes to them and say, well, my teacher said that I'm really a boy or a girl, mm-hmm. and for you to take him to a psychiatrist to get analyzed or to talk them mm-hmm. out of it. If they're making it that, God forbid you do anything like that, then you are going against the law. Now, you have all of these companies that are going out of their way, like Disney, all right, out of their way to affirm this transgenderism. They're pushing it on the kids.
They are.
We've never seen this anywhere in our history, and I'm not exactly a kid, but we need to stop this. And if it was just a matter of saying, well, you were born a boy, but you're really a girl, it's up to the parents to be able to give that kind of a talk to the child.
Yeah, not, in a normal
not
world,
up to the government.
Yeah, in a normal world, Rosa, everything you're saying is correct. It would be up to the parents. It would be obviously their recognized right to help their children in this case. But the rot has gotten so far, this gangrene of ideology has spread so far. The federal government is riddled with it. The state governments are riddled with this. The school districts across the country are riddled with this. It has metastasized all across practically every sector of our society. I'm trying to think of one where it hasn't metastasized, even into the churches in some cases. So the problem, as I see it, is systemic. It's not something that we can say that. I mean, I'm with you when you say this has to stop, but how do you stop it? How do you prevent? There's no more time, I don't think, anymore left to stop it. It's here. It's happening. It's a done deal, so to speak. They're flying trans flags in front of federal buildings now by order of this administration. They're flying gay pride flags in front of federal buildings, including embassies. I mean, what does that say? So it has reached the point now where it seems to me anyway, because people failed to vote or they were asleep at the wheel when it came to elections. Maybe they weren't engaged at the parent nights for the school board meetings and things. Thank God there are some parents who do that. But I think we've reached the point now where the last line of defense is going to be the family. As Pope John Paul II said, the way of the future passes through the family. And we're seeing this as a direct attack upon families, a direct attack upon the very nature of families, the very nature of mom, dad, and children. That itself is under attack by the people who have refused to accept reality. So this is why, for me, it's a heartfelt plea to you as parents that you, you know, stiffen your upper lip, set your face like flint, get your game face on, speak the truth in love, love, compassion, love, compassion, love, compassion, but don't allow yourself to be swept away. Otherwise, your family will go in that direction. Now, you may say, well, it's already happened. What do I do now? Well, keep speaking the truth in love. And I'm not blaming you. If this has happened in your family, I'm not blaming you, certainly. I'm not condemning or looking down on anyone. These things happen. And sometimes, well, nowadays, they seem to happen out of the blue and suddenly. So stay your course, speak the truth in love. Don't get swept away. Don't go along to get along. Don't play into the delusion. Just speak the truth in love. And I think that's where families have a chance. I have to take a break. Thank you, Rosa. I'll be right back with more of The Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. Right after this.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to The Patrick Madrid Show. The number is 888-914-9149. That number is up and running right now. I have a line or two available right now. 888-914-9149. I'd love to hear what you think about everything or anything. Let's go to Vanessa in Austin. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So actually, I just had a comment about the whole transgender on kids thing going on. So when my son was 4 years old, his best friend was a little girl, and he was like, oh, I think I want to be a girl, you know, because I love Brooklyn and da-da-da-da-da. But I think he was, you know, just a little like, oh, confused about that. And so I was like, okay, well, if you want to be a girl, you're going to wear a dress. I'm going to buy you different toys. And he was like, no. Like, you know, maybe not. I don't know. And so he's now 8, you know, going on 9, and he's very much into boy things.
Okay.
You know, hasn't even mentioned anything about like wanting to be a girl. And so I think sometimes when kids are little, you know, depending on who their friends are, who they hang out with, they might get, you know, a little confused. And I think it's up to the parent to guide them in the right direction and not try to push for a label.
A label like what, for example?
Well, like, oh, so you want to be a girl. So, okay, so let's, you know, start transitioning to be a girl, and you can be transgender, and you, you know, and it's like, whoa. It's like, they're only 4. They're young.
Right.
It's like,
right.
You know,
okay,
let them
good.
Grow up and be kids a little bit.
I had the fleeting thought for a moment that by label you meant boy and girl, which are real categories. I mean, you know, there are really boys and there are really girls, but I see what you're saying. And you know,
yeah,
one
well,
of the things,
and there are, but I think a lot of people are like, no, a girl is how you feel. It's if you want to be a girl, you can be a girl because it's how you feel. And it's like, well, no, it's science doesn't explain it that way.
Right. Yeah. The very same people who will turn apoplectic, they'll turn colors with rage if you dare question this issue, are the same people who, when it comes to things like COVID shots and masks and social distancing, they'll scream at you to follow the science. And yet, when it comes to this, that's the last thing they want to do. They're not interested in the science. And they try to twist the science to say, well, really, the science is like whatever you think it is when it comes to your gender. So how, as a mom then, if I can interpret what you told me a moment ago, I'm assuming that by doing this, by saying, oh, okay, well, then we'll have to buy you a dress and you'll have to get different toys, that was not a way of you encouraging it, but rather showing him kind of the bigger picture about what that might mean, but you didn't intend to get him dresses or anything. Did I interpret you correctly?
Correct, correct. No, I didn't intend on, like, you know, like, oh, sure, let me support you in what you think you want. And, you know, I was just like, well, then if you want to be a girl, this is what girls do. This is what they wear. This is the toys that they play. These are the dolls, you know. And he had so many superhero toys. And I was like, well, we're going to have to, you know, maybe switch from that to getting you little dollies and getting you little ponies. And he's like, no. Like, never mind. Like, maybe not.
Yeah, he's rethinking everything all of a sudden. When you're telling me.
Right, but I think had I pushed for, like, well, it's okay, maybe you can have both, you can do both, you can, you know, play with girl stuff and wear dresses and play dress up, and, you know, it's just, I think it's kind of like feeding into what they think they want.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I'm glad that you, as mom, that you had the presence of mind to be prudent about this and not overreact or not freak out or anything, but to just be prudent and kind of help him see that there's a little bit more to it than just this passing notion that I want to be a girl. Very good, Vanessa. I appreciate your contribution. And I'm hopeful that as time goes on, that your son will grow to appreciate the wisdom in the way you handled that. And I'll tell you, thanks for the call. I'll tell you, this is my honest, I would say, well-informed, carefully studied conclusion about why some of these parents, like that Disney executive woman that we heard from yesterday or the day before, she was so shocked. I mean, there aren't more queer leads in our Disney movies. We've got lots and lots and lots of queer characters in various roles, she said, but I'm shocked that there aren't more queer leads. I really do believe, after studying this and thinking about it and analyzing it to, you know, to the extent possible, that these parents are doing this not because they care so much about their children, but because they care about their own social reputation. They're in that world. They're in that milieu. They want people to think of them as enlightened and forward-thinking and progressive. And these, of course, are all misnomers, because it's not forward-thinking. It's not progressive in a true sense to be herding your child, herding, H-E-R-D-I-N-G, your child at a very young age toward quote-unquote transitioning or experimentation. It's child abuse. And that's my theory. I think that a great deal of it, maybe most of it, maybe all of it, is not so much coming from a true parental concern for the child, but for a barely disguised kind of vanity, where these parents want other people to see them as enlightened and forward-thinking and progressive and super cool. And they also will gain a certain kind of cachet. Oh, I have a trans son. Because, see, that's trendy right now. And people in certain circles, they look up to that. They respect that. I know it sounds gross, but many people do. They see some sort of value in that. And therefore, if you can add that to your, you know, list of bullet points for your personal resume, that you are the parent of a trans child or something like that, somehow in their twisted world, they think that enhances their credibility and makes them more appealing people. It actually has the exact opposite effect in the real world, but in the circles they travel in, I really think that's the motivating factor. It's almost like their kids are accessories. And they're accessorizing themselves by having, you know, well, the fashionable thing nowadays is to have a trans kid. So, oh, yeah, I've got a trans kid. Isn't that great? That's my theory. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Yoli, waiting patiently in Anaheim, the home of Disneyland. Super trans-friendly Disneyland. Welcome, Yoli.
Yes, good morning. Is it okay? I mean, is it a sin to call someone a fool?
Well, Jesus, it's interesting. Jesus said, if you call your brother a fool, you're in danger, or if you say you fool, is exactly what he said, you're in danger of hellfire. And he kind of ratchets it up. So it goes from, if you say, he said, well, let me just read you. This is Matthew chapter 5, and he says in verse 21, you have heard it said, to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, shall be liable to the hell of fire. So, strictly speaking, I think if we're going to interpret the Lord's words in a strictly literal sense, then I think one could say, well, under some circumstances, yes, it would be a sin to do this. But I would question, is that exactly what Jesus meant? And I would compare it to what Jesus said elsewhere. For example, in Matthew 23, verse 9, where he says, call no one on earth Father, for you have but one Father who is in heaven. And we know that that doesn't literally mean that you can't call somebody Father. You call your dad Father. And the reason we know this is because throughout the New Testament, the apostles, those who knew Jesus, who heard him say this, they did not understand it in a strictly literal sense. So the apostles called men Father in terms of religious address, for example. Our Father Abraham, you will find them saying, St. Paul or St. John saying, I'm writing this to you, fathers. Or St. Stephen, the first martyr in Acts chapter 5, he addressed the Sanhedrin, the same council that's spoken of here, as my brothers and fathers, listen to me. So he addresses them with this title of respect in a religious sense, and he addresses them as fathers. So when I look at Matthew 5, 22, where Jesus says, if you say you fool, you shall be liable to the hell of fire, I think that this fits into the same kind of category where the Lord may have been using hyperbole, which is an exaggeration to make a point. Like if I told you, Yoli, listen, I got to get going because, you know, Father Rocky will kill me if I'm late for doing my show. Well, you and I both know Father Rocky won't kill me. He's not going to actually do that. It's hyperbole. It's exaggeration to make a point. It's just a way of saying, I really need to get going because I don't want to be late for my show. And sometimes the Lord used hyperbole, including like where he said, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. He didn't mean that literally. None of us would have eyes. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, chop it off. We'd all be hobbling around with no hands and no feet and certainly no eyes. So he didn't mean that in a strictly literal sense. And for that reason, I think what he's saying in Matthew chapter 5 is, if you harbor hatred in your heart for your brother, that would definitely be a sin. And if that hatred is expressed in a way that you're revealing it in a public way, or you're slandering your brother, or you're bad-mouthing him by saying something like this, then yeah, that would be a sin. I don't think the word itself, fool, is the trigger for a sin being committed here. And one reason you can see this is because constantly throughout the New Testament, the word fool, you could do a word search for it, it appears over and over and over again. You know, St. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 12, I have been a fool, talking about himself in the place of God. And throughout the Old Testament, the word fool appears constantly. So that's why I think that in a strict sense, you're not committing a sin if you say that. I don't know. I hope that's helpful to you. I appreciate the phone call. Thank you for that. Let's see. Yeah, we have to take a break. Let's take a break. We'll come right back with more. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. If you call now, you'll get a free line, but if you wait, you might get a busy signal. So call now. I'll be right back.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Back to the phones we go. Let's talk to Chuck now in Pittsburgh. Good morning, Chuck. Thanks for calling in today.
Good morning, Patrick. Hey, I just wanted to comment on the young mother who talked about feeding into what the child was, wanting to be a girl when he was a boy, and mm-hmm. taking all his toys away. I've worked with kids over the last 35 years, and that's exactly the right attitude to have towards that. This whole question of gender ideology and all those kinds of things, I call it the new phrenology. Mm-hmm. Back in the old days, they used to study the bumps on your skull. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. There's no basis in science for a lot of this stuff, and I've thought a lot about it, as you have. And your points about parents using their children as accessories, it is child abuse. And I don't say that lightly, based on the fact that I've worked in a psychiatric setting for the last 35 years, and. Parents really need to think about everything they do and how it impacts their child. I can't say that enough. Just a small example, I've worked with kids for a long time, and a child will say to me, hey, I saw this, you know, the latest Freddy Krueger movie, and I think to myself, okay, maybe they snuck and watched TV on cable or something like that. But I asked them, I said, well, how did you see that movie? Oh, my parents took me to see it. And I think to myself, wow, you know, these parents are putting their own needs ahead of their child's.
Yeah.
And, you know, just making those good adult-informed decisions to help your children develop into the person that they can be. Just hang in there, young parents. I have two older ones myself. And, you know, it, just stick to it and do it for them, and it'll all work out.
Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, I think you touched on something just now. If I can rephrase what you just said, it's a very important thing that you alluded to. And that is, it's
sure.
a tremendous mistake for parents to treat their children as if they were adults, like adults in children's bodies. You know, they're
yes.
not adults. They don't have the reasoning capabilities of adults. There are a lot of adults who don't have the reasoning capabilities of adults, as witnessed by our federal government, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But
there's another
phenomenon,
too, I think, going mm-hmm. on, too. Adolescence has been kicked into, you know, the late 20s and early 30s now.
Yeah, it's true.
People are delaying getting married, delaying having kids. You know, I think kids are the best thing in the world. More people should have more of them, in my humble opinion. But I'm kind of old-fashioned, so.
Yeah. Well, parents who are going to be good parents should have more children. And in a way, I guess, sort of an odd upside to the sterility of the left and the leftist views on the world, they're... ideology is sterile and they're sterile. And I guess if we can be thankful
yes.
for anything, I'm thankful that there aren't children, 6, 7, 8 kids in a household of wacko, you know, people
yeah.
who are infecting our culture with this ideology. I'm glad they're not raising children to go out into the world with those ideologies. So that's a bit of a help for us.
Yeah.
Well, Chuck, I want to return to something that you were saying a moment ago. This is an important thing. I talked a minute ago about how parents are not doing their children any service if they treat them like adults. You mentioned taking the kids to see the Freddy Krueger movies or any such movies like that. Because children aren't equipped, they're not prepared, they're not developed to be able to make adequate decisions, you know, what to watch, what not to watch, how to process what they see and so forth. But there's a backstory or there's a subplot, Chuck, that I do believe is part and parcel of all this. And that is, the end game is they want to eliminate the barriers to having, for adults to have sexual activity with children. That's the end game, I believe, because they're working overtime to groom these children in schools. I mean, heck, they're furious that this law is in place now in Florida, which simply says that you can't talk to pre-K kids and kindergarten kids about sex. You have to talk about the 3 R's and learning your colors and numbers and things like that. And they're furious that they can't talk to these children about sex and sexual issues and deviant, perverted sexual practices. It infuriates them. That's part of it. The other part of it is this wholesale attempt. Well, it's not an attempt because it's successful, to push the kids into these situations so that they will experiment, so that they will become sexually active at an earlier age. And it seems to me that as surely as night follows day, the end game for many of them is they want to remove any barriers to adults having sexual activity with children. I really do believe that's where this is all headed. And I'm not the only person to say this, but I really do believe
it. I think you've hit the nail right on the head. And to do that to a child is just an abomination.
Yeah, what did Jesus say? He says, you know, woe, see that you do not scandalize these little ones, for woe to that man who scandalizes one of these little ones. You know, it'd be better for him to have a millstone hung around his neck and be thrown into the ocean. Hey, there's capital punishment than to scandalize one of these little ones.
Yep.
And let's take that to heart. Chuck, I appreciate your comments. I certainly do. Call me back another time, please. Let's go to Clark now. Where is Clark? In Boscobel, Wisconsin. Hello, Clark. Maybe Clark's not ready. Clark, going once.
Oh, Patrick, can you hear me?
Ah, there we go. Welcome.
Okay, Patrick, how are you today? Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Patrick, I had a dream about you last night, and I have to share this with you. I think it's funny, and I hope the audience and yourself as well.
Okay.
So, you're speaking at our parish last night, and I am the MC that's going to be introducing you.
Okay.
And you're sitting next to me. Place is packed. We're about to get started. And for the life of me, I cannot remember your last name. And I'm
that is
down
funny.
Some notes, and you're looking at me. So now I'm trying to, as I'm preparing my notes at the last second and remembering your last name, I'm trying to think of a joke about, wow, you know, Patrick's mustache looks a lot like a couple people in our community's mustache. Very bold mustache. I was going to point that out. For the life of me, I couldn't remember their names. So it was this pressure cooker. Okay, we're about to start, and I can't remember your name. And you were very polite. But I can tell you're in a big rush to catch the next flight. So anyway, unfortunately, I wake up from my dream and I don't realize what happened in the end. So there you go.
Oh, wow.
I hope. Yeah.
That is funny.
So, yeah, I just thought I'd share that. But I do have a faith-based question. But before I do that, I do want to say, Patrick, thank you for the time you take on this show to talk about matters like transgender. In a world that's so crazy about this, it's so great to scan the dial on the radio and pick up a voice that's clear,
thank you,
truthful, and explains how we as Christians, non-Christians, who just don't agree with this philosophy out there in this world, how to deal with it. So thank you for
thank
that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My faith-based question is, I have always had a question like, with our Protestant brothers and sisters in Christ, when they talk about their relationship with Jesus as a, let's say, born-again experience where they've made a turn in their life and to draw closer to Jesus, I know in a Catholic's perspective, the term born-again means to be baptized.
Right.
Now, to a Protestant...
Well, I would say, if I could interject, Clark, I would say from the Bible's perspective, that's not just a Catholic opinion. The biblical... context for the born-again experience as Jesus describes it, unless a man is born of water and the Holy Spirit, unless he's born again, regeneration, that is baptism. So it's not merely a Catholic view of things. It's what the Bible says on that topic. But go ahead, please.
Okay, yep. So now, from the Catholic's perspective, when we have a conversion, if you will, or when we draw closer to Christ, you know, we make a commitment to drive and closer to him. We don't necessarily call that a born-again experience, but what is the term that we use, and where does that term come from?
Well, the term in Greek that's used in Scripture is metanoia, and that means, in essence, turning away from sin and turning toward God. Now, it's a turn that is induced by God's grace. He enables us to make that turn. It's not that we have the power or the native ability to do this. If that were true, then the incarnation would be superfluous. There would be no need for Jesus to come and save us if we had the power to do that for ourselves, and we don't. So when we say this metanoia, this turning away from sin, turning toward God, there are different forms or different ways we could describe it: conversion, reconversion, repentance. The term born again is very common. It's deeply embedded into the psyche of Protestantism, at least a big swath of Protestantism. And so when you hear that phrase born again, that's what they're referring to, is some moment, maybe some definitive moment in their lives that they can look back upon and say, it was at this time, at this place, when this happened, that I gave my heart to Jesus and accepted him as my personal Lord and Savior. That's when I became born again. And that's all good. I mean, we don't argue with that at all, nor do we say that that never happens. When you go to confession, you go to the sacrament of confession, you've had the same kind of experience, and it would be truthful and accurate to say that each time you go to confession, you're having a kind of born-again experience, especially if you were in the state of serious sin, because the sacrament revives the life of grace in your soul, which was dead as a result of mortal sin. So that is truly a born-again experience. We Catholics just use a different set of terminology to describe it. But coming back to your earlier point, in a strictly biblical sense, to be born again, the way Jesus talked about it, is to be baptized by water and the Holy Spirit. And that's what happens, because baptism is not merely the pouring of water over the head or immersing the body into the water. Baptism actually does, it actually accomplishes what it symbolizes. It symbolizes, as St. Peter says, the washing of dirt from the body, but it actually accomplishes the removal of original sin. That's a condition. And it infuses sanctifying grace into the soul and eliminates not only all sins that may have been committed, but all the effects of sin. So it's really doing that by the power and grace of Jesus Christ in the sacrament. So that's the born-again experience. And so as a Catholic, as long as you understand, and I don't mean you personally, but I mean as long as a Catholic understands that biblically speaking, that's the true born-again experience, then all the other emotional and intellectual breakthroughs that one might have, we can understand that as that metanoia, that turning back to God. Does that clarify it a bit better?
Okay. It sure does. And I want to thank you very much for that. It does help. And you just hear these terms and sometimes you get confused as to, well, you mean it, some people mean it this way and we mean it another way. And it's just nice to have some clarification. So thank you, Patrick. Have a great day.
Thank you, Clark. Appreciate that. And I hope you have better dreams going forward, at least more entertaining dreams. Thank you. Let's go to Maria now in Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning, Patrick. I just thinking why when you see pictures of crucifixions or depictions or you know movies or whatever of crucifixions at the time of Jesus, they seem to all be tied at their hands with ropes, but yet Jesus was nailed to the cross. That seems to me like extra cruelty. Or why do you think that was?
That's a great question. And you know, it was a kind of cruelty for this reason. There were two reasons behind it. They really did tie the arms or the wrists of those who were crucified because the human body weighing what it does would pull forward and the nails would tear through the hands and likely even the feet. So that a person who was crucified and was only being held, if the cross was truly upright and not tilted back. If it was tilted back, it would not be a problem. If it was truly upright, the person, I know it's horrible to even think about it, but the nails would tear through the hands. So from a practical standpoint, because the Romans wanted to prolong the agony for as long as possible by tying the wrists or tying the arms, it would prevent that from happening, number one, and it would prolong the agony. And keep in mind that when you were crucified, unless there was some sort of a seat or a pedestal beneath your rear end that you could rest upon, in order to breathe, you would have to push up with your feet that had a nail going through the center of them, a big spike. Can you imagine the agony that would cause?
Oh my gosh, yes.
In order to take a breath, you'd have to push up to be able to breathe, and then you'd sag back down again. So the incredible pain that was involved and having the ropes there was a way to prolong that. So think of what Jesus suffered for you and for me by doing that. Thank you, Maria. I'll be back with hour two of our program right after this, so please don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.